Thanks for a nice introduction. Thanks a lot for organizers and audiences for coming here or coming online. Today I'll be talking about random matrices. Now, this is a work that was released earlier this year and was submitted to the Quantum Computing Conference, QIP, and it's largely a remake and an extension of the talk there. Okay. And before we start, I want to give a disclaimer. So I'm not really a quantum gravity person. So please don't be surprised if there's no black holes or gravity in this talk. Instead, we'll be mainly talking about two topics. One is quantum computing. The other is random matrix theory. So hopefully there'll still be enough interesting connection that can get out of this talk. Okay. So as a prologue, the talk is going to be about connecting these two topics. On the left-hand side, you have quantum computing, which recently, it's a very hot topic. And then in particular, people are interested in finding quantum advantage, right? Because it's a very practical thing. People are building quantum computers. And on the right-hand side, we have random matrix theory. This is mathematics. This is a set of tools that you can use to analyze big matrices. And we are borrowing from some recent new developments on the random matrix theory side that allows us to kind of bridge between these two subjects. So on the left-hand side, you have some new demands. On the right-hand side, you have some new tools. So they kind of match very nicely. Together, they give this punchline of this talk that I can state just in a in one sentence, that quantum computers are provably good at finding extremal eigenvectors of certain random matrices. So that's a punchline. Okay. So in fact, this punchline is fairly simple that I can explain in 5 minutes. There's very little background is needed from both quantum computing and random matrix theory. As the very first fact we know that we need to use from quantum algorithm as a black box, is that quantum computers can measure the energy of quantum states. For physicists, this is known as the Born rule, right? If someone gives you a quantum state that's a superposition of many energy eigenstates, you can say, I want to measure the states, right? And then you get return one of the states with probability equal to the amplitude. This is from textbook, right? And in fact, this can be regarded as a quantum algorithm, and people actually sit down and write down a whole quantum circuit to implement these energy measurements. These are called quantum phase estimation and Hamiltonian simulation. But we don't actually need to know how they work. We just need to assume Born rule applies to whatever Hamiltonian you cook up with. Okay. And the second fact we'll need for this talk is from random matrix theory. Is that random matrices, when you have lots of randomness, they tend to have a semicircular spectrum. I assume you have heard this somewhere when you're navigating towards quantum gravity papers. But here's a very simple fact. So if you take a random matrix and fill it with Gaussians and make sure it's still Hermitian, so these are the GUI Gaussian unitary ensembles, and you can do some numerics and see that the spectrum is going to look like a semicircle. And it works fairly well, and probably just needs to be like 100, and you can see these effects coming out. Okay. And people actually proved this in certain appropriate limits for a very particular classical, like these very nice matrix ensembles. Yeah. And if you look at the spectrum, it's a semicircle, it has a sharp edge at -2 and +2, and then that's like a very simple expression for the density. Yeah, so this is in fact all we need to know from random matrix theory. And a combination of these two leads to the conclusion of this talk. So here's the algorithm. So let's initialize your quantum states as a uniform mixture, so just a mixed way mixed state. There's nothing in it. It's very easy to prepare. And then you say, I want to measure the energy of my Hamiltonian. All right, so what's going to happen? Well, you're going to get a random sample of energy states out of this spectrum. And because the semicircular law looks like this, you can calculate how many low energy states there are. There are lots of them. Right? This is scaling here. It means that there's a very decent chance of finding a low energy state. Yeah, and then you win. You find the low energy states of this random Hamiltonian. That's the main message of this talk. Right, you may question why is this so trivial and why are you talking about this? So I'd like to give more of a motivation why this is interesting, why this is worth writing a paper. First, is why are energy states, like low energy states, interesting in quantum computing? And there are actually lots of interest in this from the quantum computing community to share with you. On the other hand, technically, how do you actually prove that the matrix you care about satisfies the semicircular law? And this turns out actually not so trivial, because you know your matrices might be sparse, may not be Gaussian. How do you say that your semicircular law remains to hold in those contexts? And these boils down to the topic of non-asymptotic random matrix theory that has been recently been developed. So let's begin with the quantum computing motivation. Very brief review. You know, like recently people are building these quantum computers. For today, they just assume we have a fully functioning, fault-tolerant quantum computer, and we can abstractly discuss the several things that's in the computer. You have a Hilbert space that's made of qubits. You know, there's n qubits, and the Hilbert space dimension is 2 to the n. And on top of that, you have unitary gates. You can act on it. These are local gates that look like this. And then in the end, you're allowed to do measurements. Right, so this is a fairly standard model of quantum computing. You can use all these in arbitrary order you like. And computer scientists has defined a complexity class called BQP that captures all the problems can be solved using this computational model using reasonable resource. Okay. And now people are very interested in what problems can these quantum computers solve efficiently. In some sense, it's the seek of quantum advantage. Right, so if you ask the question, where are my quantum advantage? What are my quantum computers good at? Here are two standard answers that you will find. You definitely have heard of. First one, factoring. That is like from 30 years ago. Now Peter Schur famously discovered this algorithm that allows you to factor large integers. And that notoriously breaks the crypto system. And today we still believe that this is a very solid example of quantum advantage. So it's an example that we all know and love. However, if you're a physicist, you might not be interested in breaking people's code every day. You might instead be interested in this second application of quantum computers, which is to simulate quantum systems. Right? You can simulate a black hole, you can simulate quantum field theory, you can simulate materials, you can simulate chemistry. People are very aware of these applications. However, from a computer science point of view, it's not very clear what kind of advantage we're looking at here. We don't know if there should be exponential speedup, should there just be polynomial speedup, or there's just very efficient classical algorithm that would solve all the problems. Okay, so this one turns out to be very unclear, and this will be the topic that we want to go deeper today. Okay, so if you look, we've opened up this quantum simulation task. The question there is, okay, so if someone gives you a Hamiltonian of interest, can you calculate some properties of the quantum system? Okay, so for example, this could be the ground energy of your favorite molecule. Or you can imagine a more complex dynamical quantity you want to calculate. And regardless of what that quantity is, you can imagine there are several things you need to do. You start with the right state, say the ground state. You need to do some time evolution according to the Hamiltonian. And do some measurements. And can use these three things in all orders you like. And as for today, the last two parts have been very well understood. There are very good algorithms for them. But the first one has remained extremely mysterious. Okay, so in particular, to give you a very concrete example, if you look at some papers put out by the companies who are trying to really do quantum chemistry simulation or quantum material science simulation, they count how expensive it is to do this simulation, and there's a big number that I don't know, which is how expensive it is to prepare a low energy state. So if that number is a billion, then we're all this industry would collapse because it's too expensive. But we really don't know what that cost is. So how come this is so mysterious? Physicists think about ground state every day or thermal state every day. How come this is difficult for quantum computers. But it turns out it really depends on what class of system you're thinking about and who you ask. Right, so if you ask computer scientists, they will say that, well, the ground energy problem, in the worst case, is really, really difficult. It falls into a complexity class called QMA. You can think of it as the quantum version of NP problem. So if your Hamiltonian lies here, it means that we expect that quantum computers are not able to solve them efficiently. And that seems to be a pretty bad news. So if this is where you want to invest $1 billion to it, to solve some problem that you cannot solve. That's kind of bad. On the other hand, if you ask people doing classical simulation, for example, tensor network or like other like DFT, other like classical heuristics, they will tell you that, well, many times these classical algorithms are really, really good. These are polynomial time scaling algorithms that solve a lot of the problems that you care about in your daily life. So you see that we're kind of being cornered by either things being too hard or being too easy. And we really want something in the middle if you want quantum advantage that would justify to someone to build a quantum computer. So we really want something that's here, quantumly easy but classically hard. And unfortunately, as of today, we don't have a like, really good model that supposedly should lies here. If you have one, I'll be very eager to know.
Why not the adiabatic algorithm?
Right, so people actually do try that on some chemical systems, and somehow there's some evidence that it seems to the gap seems to close exponentially. So it's not very clear. So in some system that works, but like not always. Seems. Cool. So today we aim to just go find something here. By providing a class of systems, which is suggested by the title, which are sparse random Hamiltonians. Okay. So we're able to say that these Hamiltonians are actually quantumly easy. We're not able to say it's classically hard because it's really hard to prove something is impossible. We only give some evidence. And in fact, the way we argue this is quantumly easy is using the simplest quantum algorithm, which is the one I told you in the beginning that you can measure at energy. So let me use a moment to describe why this family of, why these properties are important. Why do I need sparse and random? The reason why we need random matrix is because, there are lots of nice properties of random matrix. Here's the semicircular law that tells you that if you're able to measure the energy, then you win. And you're able to find something that's very close to the ground energy. And the reason why we need sparse is more of a technical reason. But, lots of physical Hamiltonians are sparse. We need it to be sparse so that it can be efficiently described and efficiently implemented. These are something that people already know. And also know that if something is dense, then the measurements do become difficult in some suitable access models. And so somehow, the combination of these still give you a sweet spot of finding a quantumly easy problem. Right, so here's a matrix ensemble we'll be talking about today. I call it the polystring ensemble. So here's how you generate this ensemble. So you just randomly pick a polystring. So it's really long. It's from it could occupy the whole number of qubits. You just randomly sample one of them, and then add them up, but weighted by a random sign. So it's just an independent sum of random polystrings. Very simple. It's highly non-local. Most likely, the polystring you have are going to overlap with each other. No, they're not going to commute. There's equal probability of commute or not commute. So this is your Hamiltonian. And the nice thing about this is that it is still being sparse, because polystrings are sparse. If you write down in a computational basis, most of the entries are zeros. Okay, there are very few ones, or point of like. So the whole thing is still being m sparse if you add up m of them. Here's an example. If there are three qubits and you add up three terms, this is like one example of a Hamiltonian you could have generate randomly. All right, so with this Hamiltonian, here's what we can prove, is that this model is quantumly easy, which means that quantum algorithms are able to efficiently find low-energy states of this model. At the same time, we argue that this problem is classically non-trivial. We only give evidence for this as being kind of hard, but we cannot really prove it's hard, but there's some evidence. And the evidence we give is that if you only have a really small size circuit, it's not going to give you anything close to ground energy. So in some sense, we are able to say that the low energy states are very, very entangled. So all the ansatz you can cook up that give you low energy states must use a really large quantum circuit. All right, so let's open up these results. First, quantumly easy. I apologize for putting out a theorem, but there's some math here, so I have to put it down. So for any accuracy epsilon, there's a number of terms m, so like how many polys you're sampling here, that's polynomially large, such that if you just draw from this ensemble, we can efficiently find low energy states, that's 1 minus epsilon of the ground energy, using an efficient polynomial time quantum algorithm. So let's look at this. The scaling of 1 minus epsilon tells you that you can tune epsilon to be as small as you want. You can go arbitrary close to negative 2 as you want. But then there's like an order limit that you have to make m slightly growing with epsilon as well. That's more of a technical issue. And then second, the algorithm that prepared the states are actually the simplest one, which is just to measure the energy. Right, again, it's because of the semicircular law. But when you measure the energy, there's some big fraction of the states that are already very close to the ground energy. And thirdly, this is average case example. So it doesn't work in the worst case, but it actually works for the vast majority of the states in this polystring ensemble. Any questions? Ah, it's just the minimum eigenvalue.
It's negative. Lambda min is negative.
Oh. 1 minus epsilon is here.
Yeah. No, I also was.
Thanks. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the ground state is it's here, and 1 minus epsilon is here. Yeah.
Does the distribution have to be uniform over the Paulis, or can you make choices there?
Not clear. So the proof actually doesn't work there. So there's some reason why this ensemble is so nice. So the fact is that the second moment of this guy actually matches the GUE matrix. So if you change the second moment, everything could change.
Yeah, these are states are low energy, but not that low energy, right? Like probably it's a lot harder because if in the large n limit, these are sort of still states that we would view as part of the thermal continuum, right?
If you convert to the temperature beta, it's pretty big beta. It's 1/ε beta.
But I think they should be volume law, not
they are volume law. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, there are lots of states here. Yeah, it's gapless, so just some low energy states. The reason that you can win is because there's so many of them. Any one kind of suffices.
Sort of.
So this is the first part of the main results, that we can find low energy states using efficient quantum algorithm. Now let's present the other side of the argument, that we argue it is pretty classically non-trivial, but again, it's not the hardness proof. We're able to argue that suppose you fix any circuit architecture, and then you give yourself the freedom to arbitrarily choose all the gates on this architecture, then we claim that if the circuit size is too small, then there's no way you can find a low energy state. So you're, in some sense, you're ruling out low depth circuit as ansatz to prepare these states. So if you look at the number of gates here, it's scaling with root m. And m is, in particular, something that you can just keep increasing. You know, you can just keep sampling poly strings, and we tell you that the circuit complexity just have to grow. Right, so it kind of give you a family of Hamiltonians whose ground states, or like near low energy states, are increasingly complex. And complex in the sense of circuit complexity. Cool, so that concludes the main results part of the talk. I'll move on to tell you a bit of a proof idea, and I'll pause for any question you have before I move on.
Well, sorry, can I ask what would you mean by it? I would have thought when you say it's hard classically,
I would have thought, and maybe it's equivalent to what you're saying, but I would have thought that what you mean is that it's hard to use a classical computer.
Right.
So this is sample, or you know, compute expectation values, or something like that. So I didn't quite see how what you said is the same as that.
Right. So ideally, you want a decision problem. You know, it's something that you can formally write down and then give it to a classical computer to solve. That's the ideal case. But we didn't solve that whole problem because you know those are really hard complexity questions. Mm-hmm. And here we just give evidence that at least you know these states are very entangled.
Uh huh. But some entangled states we can simulate, you know, stabilizer codes and whatever, right? So
That's right. Yeah. So this is just one of the you know, evidence. So okay. That's why we only say it's classically non-trivial, but we didn't say it's classically hard.
Right. Thanks.
And to add a little more, right now we don't have any way of proving classical hardness, you know, unless you use like oracles or you import like computational assumptions or you go to worst case results. But here is average case. It's like explicit Hamiltonian. So it's really hard to you know, say it's hard. Unless, like, you know, people try 100 years and fail, that would be like the only evidence. So again, the remarkable thing is that this is average case. So we try to find a good evidence as much as possible. Any more questions?
Find the low line eigenvalues. Is that obviously wrong? Or?
I'm not entirely familiar with that particular. I mean, is it classical algorithm or?
Yeah, it's a classical algorithm for finding the low energy eigenvalues.
Right, but whenever you invoke a you know linear algebra, you have to store it.
Oh, I see. It's a 2 to the n.
To the n, you okay, just pay it like in the first step. All right, so now I can move on to the idea of the proof. So I mainly want to talk about this non-asymptotic random matrix theory stuff, so that since this might be relevant to y'all, maybe. So the proof idea, again, is the semicircular spectrum. The claim is that this ensemble that we wrote down indeed have a semicircular spectrum. Okay. And then, you know, all this argument follows because there are lots of states down there. The question is, so why is the semicircular spectrum so important? Is because you know lots of things could have been wrong, right? They could have like outlier in the spectrum, you know, and then if that happens, the ground energy is not negative 2 anymore. And it could also be the case that the density of the states are fluctuating crazily, and then measuring the energy may not be a reliable way of obtaining low energy states. Right, so both of these, that could happen, you know, in a pretty arbitrary matrices. We want to say that this doesn't happen with high probability. So this is like the technical thing we want to prove. And this is kind of why the semicircular law is so nice. Right? Lots of things could have been wrong. Okay. Right, so then we can move on and see what we need here. So it turns out the proof boils down to the following statement, which is a non-asymptotic statement about random matrices. Right? So we claim that this polystring ensemble, even though it's not that random, it has very few bits of randomness, it imitates smooth properties of a very nice GUE matrix. And these nice properties include the minimum eigenvalue, this one, and also the coarse grain spectral density. Right, so pictorially, you can see that you can first draw the semicircle to guide your eyes, but then the spectrum could deviate a little bit. But the point is that this deviation is very controllable, and there's really nothing here. Yeah? So to interpret this result, it tells us that this GUE matrix, which is like really complex, has lots of randomness, you can think of it as exponentially complex. All of this complexity is not really necessary for a semicircle. So the semicircular law is a lot more robust than you might think, okay? Even for this model that does not have that much randomness. Yeah? And while it's right now maybe not so obvious why this, we expect this to hold, but as a very small hint, the second moment of this ensemble actually matches the GUE matrix. So, it's like in a scalar case, if something has the variance 1, you guess it's a Gaussian. That's kind of the spirit. Right, so you may ask, okay, so I'm new to this field, what have people been doing in random matrix theory? So here's kind of the kind of things people do. So a long time ago, people have studied all these very classic matrix ensembles that I believe you have encountered, GUE, GOE, high random unitaries, all these things. And people really know how they behave in a larger limit. They can prove semicircular law, and you can think about free probability. There are all these really, really nice things that we know about these models. But at the same time, this model tends to be too nice. It doesn't quite explain the thing we do see in, say, data science or like in physics. Right? In the wild, models are usually sparse, they're usually non-Gaussian, they could have correlations, and all of a sudden we kind of lose all the control over these very nice random matrices. Right? In particular for today, there are two generalizations we have to make. We have to make it very wild, we have to make it sparse, and at the same time we have to make it non-asymptotic, right? Because we care about finite size systems. We're not thinking about n is really equal to infinity, but just some big number. Okay? And we want to control that. Okay. Right, so how do we do that? So the method, or rather the principle we apply is called universality. And here's a picture. Okay. So in your head, we should just imagine there's an ideal model that you really know every properties about. So for example, the GUE. And then, at hand, you have this wild model that you're looking at, which is the Pauli string ensemble. At first glance, they're not the same at all. One is sparse, the other is dense. But actually, these two models match the simple properties, such as the second moment. And that somehow ensures you that you can somehow smoothly interpolate between these two models and argue that for simple properties, such as the minimum eigenvalue or the spectral density, these two models actually behave the same. To reiterate, this is a comparison result. We have started with something that we know, and we try to extrapolate as much as possible, while keeping really the minimum assumptions. In particular, this formally goes as this. You have H and H tilde. They are two matrix ensembles. They are both independent sums. And then all we need to assume is that the individual summons matches some low moments. Okay, so it's really similar to central limit theorem. You know, only know some minimum assumptions about the summons, and you sum them up, and it turns out they behave very similarly. Yeah, and there's some technical way you can carry this out. You can look at a paper. This is, I believe, could be like general framework of capturing these comparison results. I won't go into any details on this. Just want to write it down using one slide. But let's see kind of what we can get, just so that you grasp what's going on. So one property that we calculate is the moments. Right, so now, like, you can write down these p norms. That's one of the matrix functions you can write down. And we're able to show that the p norms of this polystring ensemble is very close to the Gaussian ensemble with some very highly controllable error. In particular, for any fixed p, you can make m really large, such that these two are very, very close. And the utility of controlling p norms is that you can use Markov inequality to control the minimum eigenvalue. Okay. In particular, this p only needs to be roughly scaling with n, which is logarithmic of the dimension. And then we can move on to calculate the spectral density using resolvents. So I believe some of you have done this once in your life. So this is resolvent is some function, again, of matrices that probes the density of states near a certain energy you want. Okay, so it's like some filter function that looks like this that allows you to know how many states roughly there are near that interval. Yeah, and also this universality result just apply to this guy. All right, so that's pretty much what I want to tell you. Let me just conclude with the semicircle. Today we've been talking about sparse random matrices, and we say that this actually gives a good family of Hamiltonians that is quantumly easy. And the main reason is because this semicircular law. And with that, I'd like to conclude and take any questions.
Yeah. I had a question. So in your heuristic description of, how do you get the minimum energy, you just measure a bunch of states until you find the smallest one, basically. It seemed important that you prepared a state which was a like uniform superposition of energy eigenvalues, which like in the real world seems like a state we don't encounter very often. So can you say something about like how I actually prepare a state like that?
Oh wait, so in this model, you just need a max mimic state.
Okay.
Which is just trash, you know, it's equal, yeah, it's just a max mimic state. So you can start with like random computational basis state and that works. But it's really have no cost.
Right, thank you.
Yeah.
Regarding the argument you made about the classical non-triviality,
yeah,
I think you said that you showed that no small depth circuit will give a low energy state. Is that right?
Yes.
Do you allow ancillas?
You can. This is a counting argument. But the idea is that the random Hamiltonian has so much randomness. That no matter what things you fixed, you know, if your algorithm has fixed entropy, there's no way you can find these states because these states are changing a lot across different Hamiltonians.
Okay, why do you think it would not work if we just imagine coupling the system to some larger system with low temperature that the energy could flow into the other system?
So I believe that worked, but that requires a big circuit.
Why is that a big circuit?
Right, I think that would require referring to the Hamiltonian itself. So you might need to do a Hamiltonian simulation. And that would need at least like something like this, you know. Because it needs to first know the Hamiltonian and then to do, you know, to do like thermalization, right? Because that depends on Hamiltonian. Is that yes?
How long of a circuit are you? I see. I thought is M the depth of the circuit or I'm not sure.
Right, m is the number of terms in Hamiltonian. So m is roughly like how much bits you need to describe the Hamiltonian itself.
Oh, sorry, with g gates.
And then this tells you that the number of gates need to match that bit, roughly that many of bits.
Very naive question. How do you project onto an energy eigenstate without knowing how to diagonalize the Hamiltonian?
Oh, right. So that's kind of this phase estimation trick, this one. So you can think of it as Born's rule. You know, so suppose you just have two states. We kind of know, I mean, we just assume that possible, right? Now you have lots of states. You know, in particular, it's like a continuum of states. And then people actually have worked out quantum algorithms for that. So I didn't talk about that, but people know how to do it.
So you can simulate Born's rule without actually knowing what the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian is.
Right. You only need to know how to evolve the Hamiltonian, basically. Yeah.
That makes sense. Thanks.
Yeah, I think I sort of understand your circuit result about classical, the circuit thing, but I don't understand why it's classically hard. In fact, I think it's classically easy. The Gramscial energy is -2, and all the expectation values are 0 or very close to it.
So yes and no. So if you really have a GUE, they expect the ground energy concentrates very well at -2, but in this model, we actually expect there to be fluctuations. So if you guess -2, you're not going to get the fluctuations. And I'm guessing that the fluctuation might make it hard, but it's really hard to prove. Right, because the point is that this ensemble has not much of randomness. You don't have only have like polynomial many bits of randomness. So you expect everything to fluctuate at that scale. But if you have a quantum computer, you know, you can run phase estimation at arbitrary high frequency, then you can resolve all these tiny fine-grained properties of the semicircle.
Right, but are you saying I care about greater than polynomial accuracy in the energy? Like, that's not a physics question, is it?
Yeah, this is a quantum computing talk. So.
Like, even for chemistry, I don't care about accuracy of, if I have 100 electrons, I don't care about 10^-12 accuracy in the energy, typically.
But you might care about inverse polynomial accuracy.
Well, yeah, that'd be a different question, but if you just want to know the energy, which is the starting point, then I feel like we know the energy. All right, we just use your paper.
You're right. So indeed there are two things. One is if you really want a decision problem, I want to prove quantum advantage for this very particular task, you want a decision problem, something that classical algorithm can fight. You know, now I'm saying, well, we can find a quantum state. Of course, a quantum computer cannot easily represent a quantum state. But the problem is that we at least need to first say it's quantumly easy. You know, maybe it's quantumly hard, then we're doomed anyway. Right? So you know, it's just to prove quantum advantage, you need quantumly easy and classical hard. Classical hard is really difficult, but quantumly easy, at least we can, something we can make progress on. And then you can ask, okay, based on the state I have, what task can I do? You know, can I get simulate dynamics?
Thank you.
All right, let's thank the speaker again.